Court will proceed to the fourth case, the United States v. Klevig. Ms. Hoffman.
May it please the court, my name is Gail Hoffman, counsel. I represent the United States of America. I represented the United States of America before both lower courts. Your Honor, this is a case about a man, a 48-year-old, terrorizing his 81-year-old neighbor. Mrs. Gillis had lived at her property with her deceased husband since approximately 1957. At some point in time, Mr. Klevig accumulated $5,412 in citations relating to the state of his property. He believed that Mrs. Gillis was responsible for the citations he had received, and he initiated a campaign of intimidation, harassment, and retaliation against Mrs. Gillis, his neighbor. This investigation went on for approximately 7 months. In April of 2005, Mrs. Gillis reported white powder on her lawn. That white powder burned the finger of a...
Forgive me, Ms. Hoffman. You only have 10 minutes, so I think we better get to the issue.
All right, let me...
Let me start you out, because you can see that any oil is too broad to meet the standard for particularity.
Yes, Your Honor.
How is any chemical different? Because couldn't that be household chemicals or laboratory chemicals or literally any substance, natural or man-made? I mean, why not just say chemicals that can kill a lawn, strip paint, and corrode aluminum? I mean, that really would have done the trick, wouldn't it?
It would have, but it would have been too narrow, because that would pretty much only cover caustic chemicals. And in this particular case, there are precursor chemicals that might not be caustic that could be mixed with something to cause a reaction that's far more powerful. I mean, there is testimony in the record about this defendant being able to mix chemicals in such a way along the lines of a MacGyver bomb. I'm using that terminology because that's a terminology that the witnesses used, where a combination of ordinary items cause a more significant reaction. In my initial recitation of some of the facts, what I wanted to establish, and I'll do it much more succinctly, is that there were a series of events stemming from April of 2005 through October of 2005, where there were a number of substances that were connected to Mrs. Gillis or were connected to her children. Some appeared to be caustic in nature, some were not, but most of them were unknown. In fact, one of the substances had been submitted to the Wisconsin State Crime Laboratory, and they were unable to identify it. So, I mean, clearly there were caustic chemicals, but there were many other chemicals that are covered under the definitions in the New Oxford American Dictionary of Chemical and the Webster Dictionary that would cover what the officers were looking for in terms of the search. Cutting to the chase, I mean, my position, I have a number of positions that are set out in the brief, but taking what I feel, with all due respect to the lower courts, was the more significant dispute, or the dispute that I have that I think is the most significant, is Leon. I mean, this is not a case for the exclusionary rule. The suppression of all the evidence is disproportionate to the way the officers conducted the execution of the search warrant.
Where in the record below did you preserve your severance argument?
Your Honor, that argument was subsumed in my larger argument, arguing that both the chemicals and the oils were appropriately alleged in the search warrant. This is a narrower argument of the broader argument that I made before the district court. In terms of the good faith exception, This, the remedy imposed by the magistrate judge and adopted by the district court far exceeds any violation that may have occurred. This investigation had taken place for approximately 7 months. After 7 months, the detective who presented the information wrote up very detailed reports covering all aspects of the case. She then went to the district attorney in Watertown, presented her information to the district attorney. The district attorney drafted the search warrant. The search warrant was then taken to a court commissioner or judge, and it was authorized. When they entered the house reeked of chemicals. The strongest odor was from the basement, but the smell was throughout the residence. They stepped into the house, and there was a sign that said, "Nothing in here is worth dying for." There were hundreds of rounds of ammunition all over the place, which they didn't take. There were 33 firearms, which they took for safekeeping and immediately released to the defendant's girlfriend. They proceeded to search the entire house for the chemicals and the oils that were listed in the search warrant systematically. As the magistrate found, the officers were allowed to be in the bedroom to search. They were allowed to search in the closet, and they were allowed to search under the bed where the two items in question were found, the silencer and the sawed-off shotgun. Now, clearly, there were some items that were taken that were well beyond the scope of the search warrant. But if you find that part of the warrant is valid, the search for chemicals, for instance, was valid, then United States, you know, it's my position that United States v. Buckley applies. If you find the entire warrant was invalid, this court's decision in Stefanik applies. The officers conducted a systematic search. They seized the items that were covered under the warrant. They seized items that they believed to be contraband, such as marijuana, prescription medication that did not belong to the defendant, and what appeared to be, what turned out to be, a fake bomb with fake dynamite and a timer attached to it. Some of the items that they seized were outside the search warrant. Those items should be suppressed. But in searching for the chemicals, this put the officers, the district court and low end magistrate judge put the officers in an untenable position, having to determine which chemical fit and which chemical didn't. They acted in good faith in searching and seizing the items they did. And I see my light is on, and I have time reserved for rebuttal, which I'll take.
Thank you, Ms. Hoffman. Mr. Kaiser.
Good morning. May it please the court. The district court found here that the search warrant and the way it was executed both violated the Fourth Amendment in significant ways. That's the issue, not the ones that the government a moment ago tried to inject into this argument about terrorizing a neighbor that was never proved, or that there were signs in the house of an intimidating nature, which has nothing to do with why we're here, nor that there were numerous legal arms in the house. It seems to me that the point of that was to divert the court's attention from the real issue here, and that is whether the warrant was valid, number one, and whether the officers legally executed that warrant. The district court found that neither was true, that the warrant was invalid, and the police officers even went beyond the most broadest reading of the warrant and began taking things, rummaging around the house, things that were not covered by the warrant, and engaged in what it found was a general search.
If the warrant had specified caustic chemicals, would you concede that the guns were in plain view of a properly executed search for caustic chemicals?
If the warrant had said that, yes, Your Honor, I would agree. Yes.
Then,
but of course, the district court found that the warrant was not as particularized as it needed to be, and in fact, there was nothing here to sever because none of the description in the warrant passed constitutional muster.
Did the officers who were conducting the search have access to the affidavit and the memorandum that specified in more detail what they were looking for?
That's unclear. The only testimony in the record was that they had a copy of the search warrant, but not the affidavit. But in an analogous point, it's important to know this, Your Honor. The record does evidence quite a bit of confusion on the part of the agents executing the search warrant about what they're supposed to be looking for. And it would appear that then that they didn't have copies of the search warrant affidavit there. The agent leading the search team, Sergeant Kaminsky, testified, and this is virtually verbatim, that we didn't really know what we were looking for. We had not been given any real guidance as to what kind of chemicals to take.
Well, it seems to me, unless I misheard, that you conceded just a few moments ago that the officers had probable cause to obtain a warrant for caustic chemicals.
Correct.
Then why should we exclude evidence that would have been found in a proper search for which, well, I mean, there really is probable cause here, isn't there? I mean, it's a terrible case, isn't it?
No, I agree that there's probable cause, that probable cause was in the search warrant. And the language that was in the search warrant should have been transferred to the the language that was in the affidavit should have been transferred to the search warrant to give everybody a good idea of what they're looking for. The reason why the exclusionary rule is applicable here and why the district court found that it was are several. One, even with the search warrant reading the way it was, the officers violated even the broad wording of that warrant. It would appear that once they got in the house with this search warrant, that they did not feel bound in any way by the restrictions to look for chemicals or for oil. Each time they ran into something that they were just inquisitive about.
Well, it didn't take long to find that, if based on what's described and found in this house, which is pretty amazing, actually. All these chemicals, ammunition, lots of other things. I don't know what the officers were supposed to do, but there's lots of stuff that they encountered. Now, maybe taking some little things that that list and the frozen mink and some things like that, I'm not sure why they were messing with that, but there were a lot of things in there that were legitimately attractive when they got there.
And we have no quarrel with the fact that they took the chemicals. In fact, they found chemicals within 10 minutes of being in the residence when they swept the basement. They found everything down there they were supposed to be looking for. Instead of seizing them at that time, they went back up into the house and searched the entire first level of the house looking for other things. They found legal guns, legal ammunition. Those things were there, but they admit those were legal. Mr. Klebig was not a convicted felon. But the things that they did take that they had no business taking and that bothered the district court so much weren't just a mink in a freezer. What you have there was an officer looking in the freezer, finding something that he didn't know what it was, but knew it had nothing to do with the search warrant, stopping the search for the legitimate things.
Well, maybe the officer thought that the guy used mink oil to make some of these other things.
Well, that possibility had not been raised earlier by the government, Your Honor. I've not heard that one suggested. The point is that in finding that, what the agent should have done then was put it back where it belonged. It had nothing to do with the search. Instead, the search comes to a halt. They extend the search by calling a game warden to come in, who had no business being in the house himself, to look at something they didn't know what it was, and that was outside the warrant. That scenario played out at one time or another through each of the agents that were searching this house. Another agent found a box of DVDs and videos and, again, stopped the search he was supposed to be conducting, rummaged through that box, took each movie out, checked it against an index that was there, photographed that, took the index. Again, knowing full well at the time he was doing it, it had nothing to do with the search warrant, but did it anyways.
If a reasonable officer would have read chemical to mean caustic chemical, would the severance doctrine apply, assuming the government preserved the severance? I know that's your argument, that they didn't preserve the severance argument.
Well, that's not our only argument there, Your Honor. Other case law cited by the government themselves says that the severance doctrine does not apply, again, if the police violate even the valid portion of the warrant. Again, the district court found that's exactly what the police officers did here. They did not limit themselves to the definition of chemicals that's found in the search warrant, nor did they limit themselves, and this is equally important, to the search warrant affidavit itself. Now, when the government was up here a moment ago arguing that the exclusionary rule shouldn't apply because of the case of Stefanik, I do want to address that because I think the government is reading way too much into that. Another reason why the exclusionary rule is appropriate here is that the search that ultimately occurred was not the search that was intended by the issuing court. Now, in Stefanik, a case relied on by the government, there are some analogies. There, the warrant suffered from a lack of particularity, like ours does. It likewise, the government could not invoke the good faith exception there because the defect was patent. But what the key in Stefanik was that the court said, look, the officers there paid respect to the search warrant affidavit, that the search that occurred in Stefanik was the very search that the magistrate had intended to occur. In other words, nobody was injured in Stefanik because the police officers were guided by and limited by the search warrant affidavit and only searched for things for which probable cause existed. That's light years from our situation because you have a whole list of things that the officers took that they weren't supposed to take, either under the search warrant itself or the affidavit. The search that occurred here differed in all sorts of respects from the one that the issuing magistrate, envisioned. You've got the mink, you've got the DVDs, you've got the hypodermic needles, you have 17 different containers of medication that were not called for to be seized under the search warrant affidavit. And as a result, you have injuries here to Mr. Claybig's right of privacy that were not existing in Stefanik. Nor would the, as the government argues, nor would the remedy here that's appropriate, exclusion, be disproportionate to the harm that was suffered, that would be suffered by society. If you put on one side of the scales here, you've got a single case. You have Mr. Claybig charged with knowingly possessing a altered weapon and possessing a air cleaner that the government asserts was a silencer. That's what you have here, a single case. On the other side, we would submit you have the continued viability of the Fourth Amendment and respect for the Fourth Amendment and ensuring that officers in the situation like we have here do not usurp the role that the issuing magistrate has to decide what is and what is not to be seized. You have four officers here who I'm sure are watching what's going to occur in this case. They know that the government has conceded that the warrant was at least partially invalid. They know that the government has conceded that the police overstepped its bounds and did things they weren't supposed to do. And the question is, what message should be sent to them? We respectfully urge you to send the same message that the district court did, that if you step over the line of the Fourth Amendment in the egregious nature that occurred here, then the only message to send is to discourage repetition of that kind of behavior. And we respectfully request that you affirm the district court ruling in that regard.
Well, the message is...
One second, Mr. Geiser.
Yes. Well, the message is present. That's what we're concerned. Obviously, this has lots of unusual things, but I guess when you say, well, we're going to send a message, we have to make some determination is when is and when is not a search valid. And if you're saying that everything that they did, even though they're part of it, was arguably valid, the whole thing was rendered invalid because they did too much. Is that basically what we're expected to, would that be the precedent?
I'm making the same argument the district court made, that they were not to be in the house in the first instance because the warrant was invalid and it violated the most fundamental rule of the Fourth Amendment that general searches are not permitted and therefore you particularly describe what is supposed to be seized. Number one, so the warrant was invalid. Number two, in addition to that, even after getting in the house, the police went beyond the very broad reading of the invalid warrant itself and also went beyond the probable cause portion of the search warrant affidavit, For all those three reasons, the district court found this case was exceptional and therefore called for an exceptional remedy. Thank you.
Welcome.
The exclusionary, all the cases addressing the exclusionary rule from Leon on talk about the deterrent value of suppressing all the evidence. And what is the deterrent value here? I mean, this is a, the Detective Bureau was all of these four officers. They, in good faith, did what they felt they needed to do in order to obtain the warrant. They had authorization to search the entire house. The scope of the warrant, in terms of the places that they would search remain the same. Counsel appeared to argue that because they found chemicals in the basement within the first 10 minutes, that therefore the search should stop and they shouldn't continue on to the rest of the house. Well, there is no such case law that supports that proposition, that the authorities aren't entitled to continue the rest of the search. So in terms of the violation of the Fourth Amendment, were some items taken that ultimately should not have been taken? Yes. Hindsight is 2020, they were allowed to search the entire house. So in terms of that privacy violation, none occurred because they were allowed to be in every single place that they searched. To expect the officers to know which chemical is which is putting them in an untenable position, given that they knew that some chemicals could be mixed with others to make a substance that perhaps could be more harmful. They took caustic chemicals. They went about this in a very professional way. So it's our position that the deterrent value isn't here. These officers did whatever they could to do it the correct way in that supports the Fourth Amendment. There was, from their actions, from the testimony, from their record, there is not the evidence that they went about this in any willful and wanton way. Their actions comported with the warrant as they believed it read, and they acted accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hoffman. Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. The case is taken under advisement.